Welcome to Joiners, the podcast with Tim and Danny, where each week we explore the world of hospitality by chatting with its most colorful characters.
I think I like hearing you do the intro better.
Really?
Yeah. I just struggle with the word colorful when I'm doing the intro. I can say colorful now.
I'll tell you
but
what.
When I'm doing the intro, I just stumble right over
it. You may not like to hear this, but you're the one who wrote the intro. I wonder if listeners know that we used to switch it up every week. We'd had like our own Simpsons couch situation, yeah. And we got lazy. Yeah. I know we just found the tagline that worked.
Yeah.
You're back in town. Welcome back. I want to welcome you back
into Chicago. I'm a little banged up.
Are you?
Yeah.
Ski trip. Now, you and I are different because you grew up skiing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what that says about your socioeconomic status and mine, but that is a regret of mine that I did not grow up a winter sport kid.
Yeah.
So as an adult, I chose to ski, not snowboard, because I felt like I would have more control if my feet were not connected.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think skiing's... I think it depends. Like if you skateboarded, snowboarding could be easier for you than skiing.
Yeah, I didn't either. I had no extreme sports for you. But you're a skier.
No X Games. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And we do like kind of an annual cousin's ski trip in Utah. And it's cool because like our kids are getting a little older. So they're like in ski school and they're learning to ski a little bit. And it was like the first time that Arthur was really able to like ski proper runs and not just like go on the bunny hill.
Yeah, because you would normally do like classes, right?
Exactly. So
I need a child's class.
You do, yeah.
Bunny hill run.
I mean, yeah, I think you could. I mean, you're pretty athletic.
You've never seen me on the slopes.
I think you could figure it out.
Yeah.
But I think it's like, you know, we were talking to one of the ski instructors, and it's so much about confidence, really. Like just knowing like you're not going to fall, you're not going to hurt yourself. Like that's a large part of it. So I think like with training kids or anyone to ski properly, it's just about like building up that confidence. Now, Arthur may have a unique issue in that maybe he's overly confident sometimes.
Is he?
So he's like, basically, I take him up, like, we take a chairlift, and I think that we're just going to do the bunny hill, but he and his cousin are like, no, let's go to the next lift and go even higher and go to a proper run. And
hold on real quick. So Arthur's 6.
Yep.
How old's the cousin?
Bowden is 5, but almost 6.
Okay, so they're about the same age.
Yeah, and so my cousin Jesse and I, we take the kids onto like a proper run. We take the next lift up, and Arthur just like starts bombing it down the hill, right? Like no turns,
kind of straight down.
Yeah, just straight down, just booking it. And of course, like I have to book it after him to make sure that like nothing happens. And he actually does a pretty good job on that first run. I think he has like one wipeout. You know, which is pretty normal. And then at the end of that run, I think we're going to be able to like ski back down to the base of the mountain where like Ellie's waiting for us. But as it turns out, at the end of that run is a lift to even kind of more challenging terrain. And there's nothing else you can do. Like you can't turn back.
Yeah.
So we have to take the next lift. And meanwhile, Arthur's only ever done like one proper run in his life. And that was the run we just did. So this will now be like even more advanced.
So wait, what's the rating on this?
I mean, they're greens, I'm sure, but okay. Like, you know, there's still different levels of greens.
Still hard for me.
Yeah. I mean, so we get to the top of we get off the second lift, and I immediately see like a cat trail. So like cat trails or like those cat walks, however you refer to them, are basically like little trails through the mountain where it's like kind of a cliff edge on one side and then like a hill on the other side. And it's basically to like cut from one part of the mountain to the other and to get back into like the main runs. And so I see this and I see Arthur and I'm like, I'm just like really stressed out because, you know, Arthur doesn't have a lot of control. He goes very fast. It's not impossible that he could, you know, catch an edge and turn right and go toward the cliff.
Yeah. The first time I went skiing, I'm like, I can't believe they let you do this unsupervised. Yeah. This is a very dangerous thing.
So Arthur, of course, starts like booking it and I have to like kind of book it next to him. Just because I'm trying to protect him from that edge. And
is there dialogue between you two at this point?
Yeah, of course. Like, I'm like, Arthur, you got to turn, you know, yeah, whatever. Yeah. I'm trying to tell him to slow down. Like, slow down, pizza, or whatever, you know. And at one point, basically, this happened multiple times. I had to, like, take him out just so that he wouldn't, like, fly off the cliff or,
like,
you know.
Like, knock him over?
Yeah, like, I had to tackle him and myself to the ground with skis on. And as you know, so it's like full yard sale out there. Yard sale is when you, you know, lose your skis and poles.
Everything's laying in the snow.
And so yeah, Arthur had a handful of yard sales. Somehow my skis, I think, like maintained their binding to my boots. But
were you renting gear? Did you
fly out? My brother got me boots, which was very nice. But yeah, everything else we rent. It's just like a pain to travel with it, but you know. There's some merits to having your own gear, I guess.
Yeah, and Arthur's still alive.
Yeah, he's still alive. He loved it. I mean,
oh, so he wasn't scared at all.
No, he was not scared at all. If anything, he just like is really hard on himself and thought that he was doing badly relative to his other cousins who are his age. But like, not just because he's like way more of a risk taker and just like bombing down the mountain, and his cousins are more cautious and like thoughtful with their skiing, and Arthur just like,
I wonder if that has to do with size. Like, he has the distance for him to fall is much shorter
than
a tall person.
Yeah, but it was wild, man. Also, like picking him up, like resetting him into his skis, because like he can't really get in and out of skis as seamlessly as we can or as easily. So
was Ruby skiing?
She was skiing, but she's just doing like, the bunny hill, and she pretty much like has an instructor, and like it's, you know,
yeah,
it's pretty casual.
And Ellie?
Ellie does not ski. Okay.
Because we grew up in the same area. It's not a ski area.
Also, she has like the dancer's feet, so there aren't really ski boots.
I don't know if the listeners know that Danny's wife, Ellie, was a professional ballet dancer. Like,
she was,
at the very highest level for the, was it Danish ballet?
Yeah. She danced for the Royal Danish Ballet, made it to the highest level.
Yeah.
Not sure how this is relevant.
Well, speaking of high level of performance, we had Monica Ang on the podcast this week.
It was a big get.
It was a big get.
Thank you, Mike Sula.
Shout out to Mike Sula for the recommendation. Monica has written for just about every major publication in Chicago. I mean, Sun-Times, Tribune, WBEZ. She has a podcast of her own.
Yep, with Louisa Chu called Chewing. She is a 5-time Beard Award nominee.
And she also has a book that came out with David Hammond called Made in Chicago, Stories Behind 30 Great Hometown Bites. She shares a couple of those stories with us. Background on the Jim Shoe, famous Chicago sandwich. We go deep into Pizza Puffs. But enough of the spoilers. Let's get on with the show. So without further ado,
here's our conversation
with Monica Ang.
So I was doing the red carpet at the James Beard Awards a couple of years ago, and Louisa and I are talking to everybody who's been nominated. Hey, can you stop here and tell me about, are you excited that the Beard Awards are here? So a publicist came up to us and said, hey, I'm with FX. Would you be interested in talking to some of the talent from one of the shows we're promoting? I'm like, oh, God, does the show have anything to do with Chicago? She's like, yeah, it's going to be, like, based in Chicago. So I said, okay, just bring the talent over. And this really sweet boy in a tuxedo comes over, and I said, okay, tell me your name, Jeremy. And he says, Jeremy Allen White. And I said, well, what's this new show about? He said, well, I play a guy who, you know, his brother died, and he's taken over his restaurant in Chicago. And I said, okay, well, you know, do you like to eat Italian beef? Because he told me it was an Italian beef restaurant. And I said, okay, can you even do a Chicago accent? And he said, well, what does that mean? And I said, say, I had a salmon salad sandwich in my backpack at Pat and Jack's Slacks and Pants. He said, I had a salmon salad sandwich in my backpack. I'm like, no, that's not going to work. You got to work on the Chicago accent. And so we had this nice little interview that we put on our podcast, and turned out to be a pretty popular show.
Yeah, they're doing okay.
Yeah, it turns out that show. I feel like the boost we gave them really helped.
Yeah, that's the whole difference. That was the difference maker.
Their wardrobe department was just at our office this morning picking up wardrobe for season 3.
Nice.
Rush orders only.
Any spoilers, Tim, or what? Yeah.
What's it going to look like?
What's your NDA say?
They're very similar to last season's.
Okay.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Monica, welcome
in.
Last
time I saw you was at Hermosa.
Yeah, we were
at
eating
the podcaster's
together.
Meal. And you did something brilliant that I keep forgetting to do myself, and that is that you brought your own Tupperware.
Yeah, I have to say that Louisa Chu, my chewing podcast partner, she taught me that. I go nowhere. In fact, Well, not today, not in this room, because I didn't expect any food. But I go nowhere
well,
without
we've got a surprise for you.
A plastic box. I've got several in my car. Because I hate that. You know, I hate, like, making the restaurant pay for it and not reusing them. I mean, I swear, yeah. I don't know if it's, like, if it's, you know, leaching phthalates or something. But I use those things, like, at least 20 to 30 times more after.
It's brilliant. You should just always have delis in the car.
Yes, yes. Or metal tiffins, which are even more environmentally friendly.
A metal tiffin?
Yeah.
What's a tiffin?
So in Asian cultures, a lot of them, they will bring their food in stackable tiffins. They're stainless steel metal things. And the Chinese use them. And in India, they're the tiffin wallahs who will come to like a big factory and have everybody's tiffin ready to go with their lunch. It's like, here's John's, here's Jane's.
Wow.
Yeah.
I like that. Tiffin.
Yeah.
We could manufacture tiffins.
Mm, yeah. Think about it. Branded.
Yeah. All right. So, Danny, how far back do you want to go?
Let's go all the way back. Where are you from?
I'm from Chicago, Illinois.
Fourth generation.
That's right. My great-grandfather, Joe Eng, came here in 1911. His first stop was Quincy, where he had laundromats. Then he came to Chicago, and according to Chicago directories, he was a restaurant manager at the Green Parrot, I want to say, starting around 1911, 1912.
Wow.
And so he got into the restaurant business, and he started buying his own restaurants, owning them. In the 1920s, he had one of his biggest restaurants, which was called the Golden Pumpkin, a 1,000-seater in West Garfield Park.
Whoa.
With its own house band, Thelma Terry and her Playboys. And it was the postcards say the world's largest and most beautiful chop suey restaurant. And so you could have live music and dancing and food. And then he had three restaurants at the time, lost it all in 29 stock market crash.
Yep.
Restarted again in 33 and had our biggest restaurant then that he started on Randolph Street, Hosai Gai, which was a four dining room restaurant where Daily Plaza is now. So
it the same concept in each of the four dining rooms?
No, different. There's like the modern room, the Ming room. And he had like Arthur Fanslow, who was a big interior designer at the time, design the modern room, I believe. And you can get postcards just of those rooms.
Very cool.
You can still find those online. So yeah, restaurants have been in my family's blood for a long time, though I'm the only one in my entire family, including my children, who has never worked in restaurants.
Wow.
It's weird. I just criticize them.
Well, it's never too late.
Yes. Yeah.
Why do you think that is?
Yeah. I don't know. Well, because I started as a copy clerk when I was 15 at the Chicago Sun-Times. Yeah, 1985. And I turned 16 that summer, so it was legal for the Sun-Times to employ me. But then I just never got the chance to work in restaurants. I mean, I helped out in my aunt's restaurant, the House of Eng, which was the last of the Eng Dynasty restaurants. You know, taking the strings off of pea pods and stuff, but I never worked.
Yeah. Did you just fall in love with journalism from kind of like your first day at the Sun-Times?
I did. And, you know, it's part of my lore. It's that it was total nepotism. My mom was dating Roger Ebert in the summer of 1985. And he said, hey, we need a copy clerk. Do one of your kids want to work this summer? And I'm like, well, I'll just be watching TV all summer. I might as well try something.
That's crazy.
And I did, and I loved it. And I've not left journalism since 1985.
What a trip. And what was Ebert like?
Super nice. You know, he and I were born both on June 18th. And so he took it as like fate that he should direct my entire life after that. And he said,
so you had a pretty close relationship.
We did. I saw him the day before he died. And if I hadn't needed to make a deadline, I probably would have been there like with him the day he died.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, ever since I was a kid, like he and my mom were friends when I was a kid. And then later in my teens, they started dating. And he just said, okay, now you got to go to U of I, you got to work at the Daily Illini, you have to, you know, basically be a journalist. Oh, you have to do your junior year abroad in England. And so I obeyed, and I've had a really blessed career.
Nice. Yeah.
He knew what he was talking about.
Yeah.
Wow. What a trip.
Yeah. So what were you doing at the Sun-Times at 16?
It's a job that doesn't even exist anymore. It's called copy clerk. Well, and it was called copy clerk because originally when people would be typing up their stories, clackety-clack, they would have a carbon copy so that they would be writing one version of it, and then their editor could get another version You guys know what carbon copies are.
Yeah. Okay. And, I worked on the trading floor.
Oh, there you go. Okay. And so, like, they would scream either boy or copy, and then you'd run and grab it from them and then bring it to the editor. And then there were copy girls, so then it was copy clerks. But by the time I got there, there were computers. People were using computers to write their stories. And so a copy clerk would take messages. Hello, features. Oh, sorry, Roger Ebert's not in right now. Can I take a message? And I'd use a marker. Roger, call, 20th Century Fox. That would be one part of your job. And the other is you would get these giant, wagons of mail, and you had to distribute them into everybody's mailbox. And then when the afternoon papers came up, because that's how you found out what happened in the afternoon, you'd have to go down to the deep basement and bring up the papers. So it's a very glamorous job.
Was this like a summer job type thing?
Summer job of my sophomore year of high school. I went to Lane Tech, and I loved it so much. I said, do you guys like have anything during the school year? Because like I could do it where I go to school from like 7 a.m. to noon, and then take the Edison bus to the lake, and then take the 151 to the Sun-Times and work all afternoon. And they're like, let's see. So I worked from 1 o'clock to 6 o'clock every day.
Wow. Starting junior year?
Starting junior year.
And you did that throughout
high school. And then college, I was an editorial assistant and an intern reporter. And they basically, starting in high school, they taught me how to write. So like, hey, you want to cover teen dance bars? Sure. How do I do that? And I wrote a lousy story and they said, okay, let's fix it and show you how to write.
Wow. Like structure and all that stuff.
Yeah. And like AP style. And one of my favorite things to do, and I don't think I've ever told anybody this. So one of my jobs was I had to open up all the mail for the bigwigs, the features editor, lifestyles editor, entertainment editor. And what would I see when I opened them up? Invitations. I had that one pile was just invitations. And often it was invitations to restaurant openings. And they'd say, well, Monica, I'm not going. You want to go to this? And I'm like, sure. The new Lettuce Entertainment restaurant called Ed DeBevick's Cafe Babariba. I'll go. It's a just present invitation at
the
door.
Would you go solo or bring like your mom?
I bring my mom or my colleagues. They were like, I'm going too. I'll share a cab with you.
Whoa. So you're going as like a 17-year-old?
Yes. And I was like, this is the most wonderful thing in the world. and I've never gotten over that.
This episode is brought to you by Scofflaw Old Tom Gin, a tasty, versatile spirit. Created in Chicago in 2012, the product was born out of a need for a bespoke iteration of the Old Tom style, which is the slightly sweeter predecessor to London Dry. Scofflaw Old Tom Gin carries classic notes of orange peel, juniper, and coriander while balancing on a subtle floral edge thanks to the addition of osmanthus blossoms. Its elevated proof is suitable in cocktails or unadorned. Scofflaw Old Tom Gin, complete your bar.
Were you always interested in food?
I was. My family was in food, in restaurants. We'd always go to the family restaurants on the weekends. But I was also very interested, like I was a film major at one point, and I was a film and theater reviewer. But what I found was that I was really interested from the beginning in like exploring Chicago's neighborhoods and being like the first one to check out this new falafel shop on Kedzie in Albany Park. And my mom loved that too. So we would drive around. I'd say, that looks interesting. She'd slam on the brakes. Well, let's go try it. And so
she supported it too. I mean, your family's past with food and
exactly.
Everything.
Exactly. So like my father came from a Chinese restaurant family. My mom, Puerto Rican, Peruvian, but she just adored food. Her second husband was a French chef who when I was growing up, my stepfather, before Roger came on the scene, he owned a restaurant called the Garcon Lazare on Armitage in Lincoln Park. Hmm. And so we would spend a lot of our time there. I'd go behind the bar. It was like a bar in front and then the dining room in back. And I'd be like, ooh, if I press this button, it's like all the Coke I can drink. It's like the most magical thing, that soda gun.
Yeah.
And then there are beer nuts behind the bar and Slim Jims, all the Slim Jims I could possibly eat. Who cares about the French food in the back? So,
that's wild. We're on Armitage.
So Armitage, I want to say it's like Aldine. It's one of those ones with I-N-E at the end. It's now, I believe, a U.S. Post Office or a FedEx.
Okay.
But it's one of those old ones that I was in Cafe Bernard. It's not Cafe Bernard anymore. It was Chez Moi or something. Now it's a Thai restaurant. But it was exact same structure. We're like long bar in front and then a few places to sit here. And then there's a dining room in back.
Hmm.
Anyway, so
yeah, no, this is crazy.
Got a lot of caffeine,
and so, a lot of experience in restaurants and the food scene.
Yeah, I just have never been the worker in there.
So, at what point do you decide to like pursue journalism in earnest?
Well, I think that summer I was like, okay, I'm never going to leave here. I'm going to find some way to become a journalist. And so that, I guess it was at 15 and 16. And they had me write my first article about teen dance bars in Medusa. I believe that was 1987 or 86. I looked that up recently. And it was just the most exciting thing to have my own byline on it. And then I just continued to write at the Sun-Times. Like, they let me do the fairs and fests column. So you have this whole stack of papers and say, ooh, this weekend is the Sheffield Garden Walk featuring lots of garden tours. And Paul Sebar and the Milwaukeeans will play at 2:00. And that was, like, very exciting. You learn the basic structure of writing those press release type stories. And then I wrote in college for the college paper, came back and interned at the Sun-Times, and then again college and interned at the Sun-Times. So I had to do news reporting too, which was not always the most fun, but it's really important to know how to like get in, get your assignment at 9:00 and file by 3 and be done by 5 and deal with a lot of liars in the city. The first time I was covering like the CTA outage, and I was like, well, CTA told me, here's what happens. And then this other reporter's like, and you believed him? I'm like, well, this is the official story. How did I not know I was not supposed to report?
How did you suss out the truth?
It takes a while. I would consult people who were already covering the transportation beat and say, okay, can I trust this person? Well, no, use this source, or, you know, you can quote the official city source, but you should balance it with blah, blah, blah.
Wow. It's all that, like, important insight and experience.
And it just seemed overwhelming. Like, how am I ever going to figure out who the liars are?
Yeah.
And I'm still trying to figure it out.
Is there any merit to exposing the lies rather than seeking the truth?
Is there any merit to exposing them?
Yeah, or? I mean, would you ever, like, instead of trying to find who's telling the truth, what does it make sense to?
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah.
And so in my later years at the Tribune, they moved me to the investigative unit, and because I had been doing features there for a very, very long time, and they were doing all these cuts, and it was like another round of cuts, and I remember going back to the office, and I'm like, okay, am I going to lose my job? And my boss calls me into her office, and she's like, Monica, you're leaving it's called the at play section. It was just all like leisure and food. And I'm like, oh God. And she said, you're going to investigations. I'm like, okay. And so I get down and talk to the investigative editor. I'm like, what am I going to do? They said, investigate food. So, yeah, there was a lot of exposing the lies of, you know, finding documents to show where the official story was not corroborated by mm-hmm. the documents, or simply finding documents and telling people like, hey, did you know that if you are a CPS high school student, you can have nachos, fries, and a chocolate milk every single day of your 4-year time there? And that is considered a healthy meal according to the National School Lunch Program. These are subsidized meals that are supposed to be healthy. And the Deputy Secretary of Agriculture, who oversaw the program in D.C., did not believe me. And I had to prove to him that this was the case. And kids at CPS hate me today because I was the one who got the nacho and fry combination down to one day a week.
That's fascinating.
Wow.
What other things were you investigating in food?
Well, wait, how did he respond once you were able to prove it?
He's like, how can we be supporting this as a part of,
like,
you know, a healthy lunch?
Like, that's my point.
Yeah. And what I found out was the reason why they did it is because the caterer at that time, Chartwell's Thompson, they are paid by the lunch that kids take. And so, of course, they'd want to create the most tempting combination because cha-ching, cha-ching, cha-ching.
Wow.
If you're giving them,
what
you know,
to kids.
Like lentils and kale, they're going to be like, nope, don't want it.
And then they don't get paid.
Exactly. And that's a perverse system.
That is a very messed up system.
So I exposed a lot of that. I mean, exposed, it was, you know, in plain sight. But So then I looked at gardens, that kids were finally getting school gardens, but they were not allowed to put a single leaf of basil on the pizza, let's say, in the school. You could never take anything from the garden and serve it in the school because the caterer said, that's dangerous, the kids will die. And then I talked to, another undersecretary of agriculture whose PhD thesis was how kids are much more likely to eat food if they grow it themselves. And then that started the whole CPS garden to school program. So it was just, it was a series of investigations about food and about food additives and what we allow in our food versus what Europe allows in your food.
Oh, yeah. I've seen the side-by-side images of, like, school lunch around the world compared to America. It's jarring.
Yeah. You go to France, you're like, what? You're eating in courses? You're all eating together at a table and pouring each other's water and having a cheese course at the end?
So were you tipped off on some of these topics, or was it up to you to find what you were going to investigate?
Sometimes we were tipped off, and I can say this now. One of our biggest investigations was the head of Chicago Public School Food. So she's the one who decided who gets the multi-million-dollar contract. We had an informant who said she's taking enormous bribes from the person who's going to get the contract. And we're like, okay, we need proof. Yeah. And so we were able to get the documents of the bribes that the company filed as expenses. Like, we needed to take, okay, her name is Louisa Sion. We're taking her, okay, to be in a CPS employee, you have to live in the city. She had a pied-à-terre in the Gold Coast, but she really lived in Milwaukee. And so do you bribe her? What do you bribe her with? Tickets to the Green Bay Packers game at Lambeau Field when Brett Favre returns as a Viking. Limousine up there and all sorts of jerseys for her relatives, all expensed, all in black and white for us. And as an investigative reporter, that's what you need. You need the documents. And when presented with these allegations, she told the inspector general, well, I saw everyone else doing it.
Yeah, great defense.
Yeah, what are you, in fifth grade? So sometimes...
Wow, did the caterer lose the contract she got fired?
Chartwell's Thompson lost the contract and Louisa Sion lost her job. And then the next person they hired for that job was someone who used to work at Aramark. And what do you know? Aramark got the next contract.
I mean, that happens at every level of, like, even up to the Supreme Court. But when it happens in the Supreme Court, is there just no one higher to... call them out?
Well, people have been calling them out. The Senate Judiciary Committee has been calling them out and saying, shouldn't you guys come here and testify before us and have a very standard set of rules? They're like, no, we don't need no stinking standard set of rules. And it's
in our best interest to keep them there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous.
That is.
So I've done both, you know, Monica sits down and eats every single dish at the Taste of Chicago in one sitting, and Monica has to go through all these documents to expose wrongdoing in school food procurement.
Was that the longest rabbit hole you went down?
Yeah, it was one of them. Another one was at WBEZ where I looked at a food scientist at the University of Illinois who was going around the world advising countries about their regulatory standards for genetically modified foods. And he was telling them, hey, this Monsanto stuff is terrific. You should get GMO corn. And it turned out he was getting a monthly payment from Monsanto. And he was saying in his emails, which are FOIA-able, I could get them through the Freedom of Information Act because he was a public state university employee. He was typing, hey, when you send my next payment, be sure to send it through the U of I Foundation so it's untraceable. and then typing, hey, I'm going to China. Do you want me to tell them the same things you told me to tell them in Korea? I'm like, dude, why are you putting this in your emails? You know I can FOIA these.
What were the repercussions of this?
So I say to the University of Illinois, my alma mater, hi, you know, these emails, they look really, really incriminating. And I also see that he hasn't disclosed these payments on his yearly disclosures. I'm sure there's a reasonable explanation. I would love to talk to someone at the university about it. They stonewalled me. They had everybody at the university, do not talk to Monica. The professor... he said, okay, I'll talk to you. I'm like, great. Yeah, I really want to get your side of the story. Because I did. And then he canceled twice. And so it was nothing. It was just crickets from the other side. And I said, look, I'm going to be presenting these emails. If you have any exculpatory information or any way for us to put this in context, please give it to me. Nothing. That was like a year-long thing.
Whoa.
How did it end?
He left the university. And the university was just basically stonewalling me. I was thinking that my daughter wouldn't get into U of I because they were so mad at me. And strangely, there was this whole thing where I was FOIAing the emails, and another group had already FOIAed them. And I said, I can't take the results of your FOIA. I need to do it myself. Show me the exact language you used, and I will re-FOIA and make sure these are the results that come back. So I kind of cut and pasted their language. And one of, like, I think their zip code from them ended up on there. And the U of I said, clearly you're in cahoots with this, it was called, just label it, this organic group. Monica, you're clearly working for this group. I'm like, no, I needed to re-FOIA their language. And then when the story came out, a bunch of trolls came after me. And they said, Monica's working for this organic group.
Oh,
how
man.
In the world could they have known that if U of I didn't leak that to them?
That's so weird.
Yeah, it's like so creepy.
Yeah, that is weird. What's a FOIA?
Oh,
Freedom
it's
of Information
called,
Act.
Oh,
so it's
okay.
Like using that freedom of information.
I got
so
you.
So the press and the public have the right to see documents in public documents that are government documents.
Got it.
Whoa.
So.
All right.
Probably so, more than you wanted to know.
No, that's fascinating.
I think it's super fascinating. Okay. So now working within Chicago's food scene, what are the things that you are trying to, you know, explore? You have a podcast. You've just released a book kind of going over these great places throughout our city. What are the things that you try to focus on now? I mean, you work for Axios right now, right?
I do, yeah. And so, you know, I've got a story today about the mayor's cabinet. Like, has he finished firing people? It's unclear. but at the same time, I've got stories about Gino Bajena. So this chef who used to have Ixtapozalco and Chilpancingo, he's back. He's taken over the whole area at Lalo's Tacos, 380 seats. Mm. And he's bringing his incredible moles back. So I'm going to do a piece on that. And I did a piece on the square croissant, the Underberg croissant at Bittersweet, which, because it needs to be sturdy, is really chewy. It looks really cool, but you don't want your croissant to be like, kuck. Anyway, so I'm exploring that, but also I really want to do a piece about how one fair wage or the gradual loss of the tipped minimum wage is going to affect Chicago's dining scene. So I've been checking out different styles of service that we're seeing from people who kind of want to get ahead of it.
Yeah.
And so I went to John's Food and Wine recently. Mm-hmm. Do you know their service model?
I don't know their model, but I've seen great reviews of their food program.
Yeah, I read it in Nagrin's review.
Yeah. Okay. So, yeah, you get in there, and it's kind of bunched up right at the beginning because everybody's looking at the board and deciding what to order. So you order at the bar, and then they bring the food to you. Then they seat you, and they bring your food and your wine to you. And they say that they're able to pay people $35 to $40 per hour, even in the back of the house, by eliminating the person who comes and takes your order.
Yeah.
They still have people running the food to you. So I'm looking at that and Thatu, and I think maybe Honey Butter. I just want to look at three places that are getting ahead of, that have gotten rid of the conventional tipping and how it works. And
does like... Do Daisy's and Lula fit into
right.
those?
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
And I should do...
And Giant, I guess.
Yep. Yeah. So now you give me four more places.
Akahoshi Ramen.
Right. Yeah. And I'd love to know from you guys, like, what are the models that you've seen that work, and do they work?
Yeah, I mean, that's a loaded question for us. We kind of have different models throughout Scofflaw Group, and we're still kind of exploring the right ways and the best practices. But yeah, certainly costs of things, labor are going up significantly. So yeah, whether that means fewer servers in the future or a different model, you know, we're trying to figure all that out.
Yeah.
It's kind of early to say.
It's proof of concept for most places, it seems like.
Yeah. So you can watch all these experiments and kind of see who's doing.
And I think people are talking within the industry.
Yeah.
Luckily, you don't tip on uniforms, so
I think we're also
all
like,
good.
Yeah, we're a bad subset probably because we're more understanding of it than probably most people. So whenever we see like a service model, we're like, cool. You know, I mean, it's hard to be like super critical of it in these early stages.
Yeah. And it's hard to say how much the diner is going to start doing these calculations in their head. 14%, you know, it's going up by 14%, which means I need to readjust my tip to this. I mean,
yeah. And some people, you know, we were talking about it the other night. We were eating with Ronnie and Sula at Akahoshi, and mm-hmm. we were talking about, you know, some people don't mind the supplemental, you know, 2-5% charge that covers health stuff, whatever it may cover. Some people would rather that be built into the prices. It's just like, it's not, there's no like one size fits all.
Yeah. I think as a diner, I'm more interested in my out the door price per head, because that's really all that matters to my bank account.
Yeah. And that's why I talked to the guys from John's, and I've talked to other restaurant groups. I said, why don't you just build it into the menu price? And they said that didn't work at Gramercy Tavern. And
yeah, well, Danny was like ahead of it. Yeah, at Gramercy and stuff. Yeah, but he also made like a bold declaration of like, we're ending tipping. He made like a big deal of it. I think if you approach it maybe a little bit differently, like Giant or Daisy's or Lula or, you know, Honey Butter or wherever you're talking about. Yeah. Yeah, I think if you're just like, this is how we do business, take it or leave, you know, I don't know.
Yeah.
Like, this is what we feel like is the best, you know, for our staff, then you kind of believe them. Why would they make that up? But when you make like bold claims about ending a practice that has existed in this country for a long time, you know, the tensions
rise. And so early,
people
too.
Get stoked. And and he was very early. It was almost, he almost got like punished for being ahead of it.
Yeah.
in a weird way.
So what do you guys think? Built into the menu price or added at the end?
I prefer that myself.
Built in.
So that's eliminating a tip and higher prices on menu items?
Well, there's three that I'm thinking of. I think I'd rather the classic way of just leaving, you know, a 20% tip, whatever. But what's frustrating is when you get like the supplemental charge plus the tip line, plus prices aren't that cheap anyway. And you're like, if I don't leave a supplemental tip on top of the service
like
charge, am I a jerk? Yeah, it's just, and
it's
I don't
a major concern of mine.
Too. Yeah. And it's just like, yeah, I can feel good about myself, like leaving 20+% tip.
Yeah.
But it's tough when it's like an automatic 16 or 18% or even 22%. With then getting the tip line at the end of that, and you're like, what the?
And that's what the John's guy said. They said, you won't see that tip line. And then we don't encourage people to leave more. But then I went and I saw the tip line. I love Poly G's. I love them. But twice now, my co-writer on Axios, we were getting pizza for an event, she tipped, and then she noticed that there was already a tip on there.
Yeah,
and then my partner the other night, he's like, wait a minute, I already tipped, and there's...
I think that's like people don't want to feel like they're getting taken advantage of.
Yeah.
And I think that's like my sensitivity.
Yeah.
Another issue is because there's no standard, everybody's different. So you always have to be paying attention.
For sure.
Just that's, be like, that's hey, in point. Chicago, this is how we do it.
Exactly.
It'd be so much easier.
Yeah. But you've got to like adjust your brain and your math for every single one.
And also, I think what gets confusing to me too is there are, let's just say, like independent butcher shops or something. And then it's like you order your meat and your cheese. They weigh it, they pack it up, and then there's like a tip line. And you're like, well, am I at like a grocery store, or like was this level of service necessitating a tip on my end? It's just like super awkward.
And I
just
feel like a jerk for even wondering.
Yeah, I feel I just don't appreciate the awkwardness, the guilt. I'm someone who lives with a lot of guilt probably. Anyway, overthinking everything. Like, it's just a miserable experience.
I love Coffee and Tea Exchange. And I'm always prefacing everything. I love them, but I'm over on Broadway. But I go there, you know, hey, okay, like a bag of green tea. I hand it over. Okay, will that be a 25% tip on that? Like,
you're like, what?
You just handed me a bag of tea, man.
Yeah,
I know. I think about that too. Like All Together Now. Great spot. Love going there. Got to preface it with that. It's one of my favorite spots. But every time I'm like, if I'm just going in to get cheese and wine or something, do I tip? But then I'm like, well, if I have an associate help me pick out the wine, then I feel more obligated to tip. Yeah, it's like, what level of service
am
I?
It.
Yeah, exactly.
I think that the unfortunate part, I think, if we're, you know, trying to anticipate the future, if enough of us have these uncomfortable experiences at independent shops, then we're just going to go to bigger
chain places
like, that don't do that.
McDonald's didn't ask me to tip.
Or Trader Joe's or Whole Foods to get your cheeses and meats. Right. Like, it's tough. And I think that, that's the frustrating part for me and somewhat depressing.
Yeah.
As well.
I mean, maybe when it all pans out in a few years, it'll be different, but we're going to have a very confusing next few years.
Yeah. I feel like there are significant growing pains right now.
Yeah.
And we're probably not used to it. So that's part of the friction as well.
Or you could just zoom out and work on income inequality.
Yeah. Or, national health care.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. For sure.
I talked to this guy, Jacob Potashnik, who's opening this place called Feld. And he...
This is your most recent episode, right?
Yeah. Oh, thank you for listening. And he talks about this model in Germany and I think somewhere in Scandinavia where he worked and how, you know, you can treat the worker well and you can serve this top-line food. And I just wanted to remind him, I hate to, like, you know, crap on his idea, but, like, these countries have national health care.
Yeah, it's different.
So, yeah, you can pay a different model and you can subsidize, you know, them in different ways, but that's already taken care of. And that is a huge expense for people. It's already
100%.
Taken care of.
Yeah. Yep. That's very true.
All right. Let's talk about some uplifting things.
Yeah.
So now what's your level of control over what you write on? Is it totally up to you? What are you seeking out?
It's pretty much up to us because our editor is in Washington, D.C. And so they said, we hired you guys for your news judgment. So it's just, okay, cool. And especially when it was just Justin and me, we were like, we need to fill, you know, 5 to 7 newsletters every week. So let's just throw out ideas. There are no bad ideas, you know.
Wow.
If while you're in the course of executing it, you're like, this is a crappy idea, you know, you'll just get rid of it. But it was just think of an idea, do it, done. Now that we have Carrie, which is great, we can be a little more choosy. But it's just this would be fun. Let's try it. And if it doesn't work out, next day we got a whole new newsletter to do.
So what's your writing routine like? At this point, you've really kind of honed the craft.
Well, I mean, and I had to learn to write smart brevity. So I was a writer for what was called Tempo, which was a long feature section in the Tribune for a long time. And so these were all really long stories. And so now everything has to be written in 250 to 400 words. So just learning how to do that with what we call axioms, some people might call subheads or bullets, that actually, it creates restrictions that and formatting that actually makes things easier. So you have to have your lead and then why it matters. And you got to think, okay, why does this matter? Why am I even writing this? Then what they said and details and what's next. So it actually makes writing fairly easy. And long interviews that I used to do like this, nope. What I need from you is you to send me 2 sentences.
Yeah.
Just totally distill what you want to say. Send me a sentence and a picture, and that's what I need. So it does make writing easier. It does make cranking out 5 stories a day, you know, between 3 people, a little easier.
And are you doing any official, like, restaurant reviews anymore?
You know, we're not. That's what I asked them, and they're like, we don't really want to do reviews, but we want to give people enough information so that they know if they want to go. So prices, ambiance, you know, what kind of what's the vibe behind it, what's the intention behind it. And when I was at the Tribune, so when I was a Sun-Times copy clerk, I could go to every restaurant opening I wanted. Tribune, it was really locked down. I remember Panera, they wanted to come and talk to me about it. They're upping their coffee program. And they came, and my editor's like, okay, you can talk to them. So I sat in the cafeteria and talked to them. And I said, you know, and they gave me a cup of coffee to try. She's like, fuck it, you can't do the story now. And I'm like, what?
Because,
like,
your reaction to the coffee?
No, because I took a free cup of coffee. And we would say to our editors, hey, everyone's going to this restaurant opening. We could try a whole bunch of new. You are never allowed to go to restaurant openings. So
Whoa.
I was very much in the way of never, ever, never allowed to go to any of those things. At the Tribune, and that
Bees, they were like, only Phil.
Well, Phil, well, he would go, but he'd pay.
Yeah, no.
He wasn't allowed to go. Like, so, like, and we had this enormous budget, you know, just thousands and thousands of dollars, so we could expense our meals and go anonymously. But at Axios, they're like, look, you can go. You need to disclose. It was a press night, and if it's terrible or if it's not worth our readers' time, you don't have to write anything.
Right.
And so that's sort of the medium. You know, I still talk to Louisa, and she's still under those lockdown rules. I'm like, I get to go to this place.
Do you feel like what makes a restaurant great for you is the same as what makes a restaurant great for her, for Louisa? Do you have the same kind of grading rubric?
I think so. I think, you know, and you guys may not want to hear this, I think I'm still more food. Like, treat me like crap. I don't care. If your food's good, I do not care. And I think, well, for her job, she also has to care about hospitality and ambiance and stuff. I remember one time when I was in the at play section, and we were reviewing this place called Yasa. It just opened up, the Senegalese place in Bronzeville. And we get there, and we have like 1 hour for lunch. Even though we were working, all of us decided to go, like five reporters decided to go. And we get there, and we order. We're the only people in the whole place. And it's like 45 minutes since we ordered, and still no food. We're like, we're going to get in trouble. We're not going to make the meeting. And so finally, I got up to go into the kitchen and say, look, please don't bring out the food. We got to go. And we were really angry and hungry. I said, no, two more minutes, and the food will be out. They put this Yasa chicken on our table, and we're like, this is the most freaking delicious thing I've ever had in my life. Wow. And we gave them a good review, even though every other part of the experience was horrible.
Awful,
they were just awful. It's just like dismissive. One woman, as she's taking her order, she's like, I'm feeling really tired today. It's like, yeah, thanks. And so I would have given the place 3.5 stars, you know, okay, half a star off for like terrible service and ambiance. But that food was so good.
Yeah.
Do you think that if you hadn't waited as long and you weren't starving, it would have tasted as good, though?
That's a good question. Yeah. Hunger certainly
tactic.
Hunger is a very effective spice. but I've been back, and it's just beautiful chicken.
Yeah. So it's still around.
Oh, it's still around.
Still, we gotta go. Still killing it.
Yes. Go to Yasa, but make sure to like eat something before you go.
Bring a snack.
The service is a little better now. Yeah.
So what do you find resonates? Like, you know, you can kind of crank out ideas and then you get the metrics afterwards. What kind of trends do you see? Like, what are people into now that maybe they weren't into a while ago?
You know, it's weird. I did a story early on in Axios. I went out to Aurora, was it? There was a new Asian mall opening there. And I had five pictures of the dishes I got in the food court. I said, new Asian mall, Aurora wants to become a center of Asian dining. And that story did gangbusters. And then when I reviewed Gangnam Market, same, you know, here are like five things you can get at Gangnam Market. For some reason, those really took off. It's hard to know because in our newsletter, we have 130,000 subscribers. And we don't know, we know that at least 50% are opening it up. But what we measure are those who come to the story through Google and who go to our website. So we don't know like how popular the ones are in the newsletter because we don't know. Maybe 60,000 people are reading it every day. But from the website ones, we know that those stories do well. Stories about, like, you know, quirky foods do well. Hmm. You know, and is that just because of novelty? And everyone's like, look at this weird, you know, Underberg croissant.
What's most shareable?
Yeah.
Do you, with that information, do you find that you cater headlines? Like what?
Goofy stuff.
What's most clickbaitable? Yeah.
Well, like Jim's does a new Polish sausage breakfast burrito, and people really loved that.
Okay. So,
and
so
it's
the
delicious,
thing.
By the way. Yeah.
All right.
Have that for your next breakfast or serve it at your next fancy brunch. Super delicious.
All right. Nice pro tip.
Yeah. And what about the emergence of amateur influencers on the food scene? What's your take on that?
I don't want to judge them.
I think it's a huge spectrum. I think that... the worst people looking just for a free meal, I think that they're getting called out more and more. But there are, you know, there is some integrity on that spectrum as well.
Yeah, I think if they're transparent, you know, it's like I took this free meal with the promise that I would write something nice. If that's what the deal was, I think If they're transparent and people still believe them, that's great. But if they're not transparent, if they just act like, I am saying this completely independent of anything, that's not okay in my book. But I had the luxury of enormous expense accounts at the Tribune to be able to buy all the food I needed to. And at Axios, most of the time when I write about food, it's stuff that I'm expensing, and they have not pushed back on any expenses yet. These young influencers, they don't have an expense account. But I think that transparency can take care of a lot.
Mm-hmm. On the topic of AI, where do you feel that fits into journalism?
It's really scary. I mean, do you remember the months when everybody was so scared about AI and that guy from Google quit and it was like, this is really bad. And like, did that just all go away? Now we're all just diving right in.
Yeah.
What happened to that? One of the things our bosses are telling us is that we need to establish subject matter expertise as Monica, as Justin, as Carrie. Why? Because AI can eat our lunch on a lot of it. Mm-hmm. You know, as you already see, type into Yelp, the best, corn dog fritter in Chicago. And like, it's not always right. Like, some of the places aren't even serving a corn dog fritter. That's not even a thing.
not yet.
But, right.
I kind of like it.
So, right. It's the next hot meal. But they say you need to establish that you're a real person and that there's some value in what you say, because AI can do those roundups a lot faster than we can. And, I don't necessarily see a place for it, although I hadn't even realized when I use Otter. Do you guys know what Otter is? Mm-mm. It's a transcription software. So when the mayor is giving a long speech and I need to make sure all those quotes are right and they're transcribed, I just turn on Otter. And that's AI. So transcription software.
Is it good? I assume there are a lot of them. I'd like to transcribe the podcast. That's why I asked. Yeah.
There are a lot of mistakes depending on someone's accent or how clearly they speak. And so you do need to go through it just to make sure something's not wrong.
We'd have to go through all Danny's mumbling dialogue.
There you go.
Impossible. No AI can figure that out.
But some of it, you know, depending on the speaker, some of it can be very, very accurate. It's not perfect yet.
Yeah. Okay.
But so I guess I do use AI in that way. I think that a lot of journalism, unfortunately, is going to be written that way. Monica's Fares and Fests column, that can just be harvested from people's listings, you know. It starts at 1 o'clock, it ends at 5 o'clock, admission is $2, that can be scraped. But I mean, still, you're seeing a lot of mistakes in AI-written stuff that makes me think, okay, they still need humans.
Yeah, there's still hope.
Yeah.
On the topic of expense reports, as that's kind of dried up and print has kind of gone the way of the dinosaurs for digital content, how has that compromised journalism? When journalists have to come out of pocket for food, are they covering fewer places? Are they more selective about where they're going? What's the negative impact of that? And what's the reason? I mean, is it just that publications are struggling?
Yeah, you know, I did this profile. I don't want to toot my own horn, but it's a really nice profile for Chicago Magazine last year of someone named Paula Camp. And when Paula Camp was at the Tribune, Paula was Paul Camp, the chief restaurant critic at the Tribune in the 80s. And I once asked her, I said, so how many times did you go to restaurants? Up to 20 times. And I
for one review.
Wow.
Never got a pushback. Never was told we're spending too much money. Flash forward to today, Louisa does have a budget, and she's told to stay within it.
How many visits?
I think she does at least two.
Okay. Allowed to do three, but at least two kind of thing?
Yeah, and it's a very different world. Hmm. And I think that, you know, obviously 20, and I was like, really, Paula, why did you go 20? Well, because people kept telling me it was great, and I thought maybe the next time I went, I'd understand what was happening.
How do you even reference your notes on that? It'd be insane.
Yeah. And I mean, that was extreme.
Yeah.
But it has changed today. And, you know, for me, my bosses say, if you're just going to mention something in a story, I don't want you spending more than $50 at the restaurant. Because like, they still want me to do like the 10 restaurants that opened this month, and if they're interesting, I want to at least stop by. And so I think it really has affected people's ability to really thoroughly review something, and certainly those who are doing it free, I think they probably, for me, the really interesting thing is if I get something free, I feel the need to, like, I really want to lean towards saying something bad about it, you know, something true and bad.
Yeah.
If I pay, I feel fine giving it a glowing review because
for sure.
There's,
you know,
there's no
your
guilt.
Your conscience is clean.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can we talk about your book?
Yeah, please do.
Okay. Made in Chicago, on, yeah. Stories Behind 30 Great Hometown Bites. Where did the concept come from?
Well, so for the last 35 years, I've been covering food, and sometimes I've been covering the origins of certain foods. And I remember when I'd been looking at a lot of South Side foods for a while, I was having lunch with my friend Bruce Craig, who is a he's a food historian, written several books about hot dogs. And he said, Monica, you should really do a book about all these foods that come out of the South Side. University of Illinois is starting an imprint just about Midwestern culture. I think it would be a great selection for that. I'm like, Bruce, I don't have enough time. You know, I'm just trying to, like, keep my hair washed. Because you see, I haven't washed, you know, trying to keep my house clean. I'm trying to keep the tax man at bay. And basically, I don't have enough time. And then I ran into Dave Hammond at a party, and I was like, you know, boy, yeah, I wish I could do this book. I have no time. He said he could write half of it. And I said, okay, so let's come up with 30 things that we know have been invented or perfected in Chicago. And we pitched it to University of Illinois Press. They said yes, and over COVID, we wrote it. And I thought it, and I couldn't believe that there really hadn't been a book like this. There are a few books about Chicago dishes, but they hadn't really dived into some of the more obscure ones, or I think the wonderful immigrant stories about where they came from.
Yeah.
And so I said,
yeah,
you
I
know,
gave it to my brother-in-law for Christmas.
Oh, thank you for doing that.
Yeah.
And for me, it's always like, you know, my friends, a lot of my friends, I hope they're not listening, have had books that I bought and did not read, but I really wanted to write something that I would read myself.
What were some shoe-in dishes, and what were some that maybe surprised you?
You know, obviously the Chicago-style hot dog. You know, we tell you where every ingredient comes from. Deep dish pizza, although we have debunked the Ike Sewell invented deep dish pizza theory. But then,
so where does deep dish come from?
Well, probably three people: Ina Mae Redmond, Rick Ricardo, not Lucy's husband, but another Rick Ricardo, and
not her son either,
yeah, right.
Little Ricky,
right, right, and Ike Sewell. So Rick Ricardo, he was living in an apartment over Uno's in the 40s, and he had a new baby who could not get to sleep because there was a raucous bar on the first floor. And he said, darn it, if I rent out that raucous bar then and make a restaurant in there, then my kid can get to sleep. And he was Italian. He also owned Ricardo's on Rush Street, and he was also a painter. And so he decided, actually, he and Ike Sewell, who was, I believe, a liquor salesman who was able to get the liquor license, they decided to go in together, and they were going to do a Mexican restaurant. And then they said they had a tasting one night, and everybody got sick. They're like, no way, no Mexican. Let's do something Italian, but make something that could be a whole meal. And then they came up with it together, near his dying day, Studs Terkel said, why is everyone saying that Ike Sewell made it up? The effing pizza was Rick Ricardo. And it was actually called Rick's Pizzeria at one time, if you look in the business records. So we believe that Rick Ricardo made it. He died before Ike Sewell, his partner, died. And then Ike was kind of this great salesman, and he was like, yeah, I did it. But originally what we learned was it was not a hit. It was kind of a dud, and nobody wanted this really heavy pizza until Ina Mae Redmond, who was a cook from the South, came in and cooked in their kitchens. Their kitchens were almost all African-American cooks. And that was the case probably through the 80s. In Chicago kitchens. And she was an expert biscuit maker. And she said, we got to lighten up this crust a lot. Once she did that, that's when the pizza took off.
Hmm.
And so we kind of tell that story in the book. And Tim Samuelson, who's Chicago's cultural historian, supports this theory as well. So those were the shoe-ins. But then I really wanted to find out, you know, what was the origin of steak and lemonade restaurants in Chicago? Where did the gym shoe come from? I found out a really interesting story about the pizza puff. I had no idea that it came from, I believe, Iranian Christian immigrants to the United States at the turn of the century, Elisha Shabazz, who turned baby buggies into hot dog carts. I can tell you the long story. So I'll give you a shortened version. So he's like, okay, hot dog carts, that's the big thing in Chicago. I'm going to take these baby buggies, put a steamer in them, and then sell all the equipment for people to start their own little business. So at the end of the month, he would go to his customers and his clients and say, okay, I need the rent for your hot dog cart and your hot dog supplies. And he goes to this one house, and a woman answers the door and said, I'm sorry, I can't pay you this month's rent. My husband died. And he's like, oh, man. She's like, all I've got is this tamale recipe. So she gives him this corn roll tamale recipe, you know, like Tom, Tom, and Supreme.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, okay. He takes it back to his warehouse, and he makes it, and he starts what's called Il Taco. It's still there today, Illinois Tamale Company, this company called Il Taco. Okay, then his son takes over the business, and they're still delivering to hot dog stands, but now they're brick-and-mortar hot dog stands with something called a French fryer.
Hmm.
And they say, Warren, we love all the stuff you're delivering to us, but these pizzerias that are popping up, they're killing us. What can we serve here that can compete with these new pizzerias? Warren said, let me think about it. He goes back to the warehouse. He gets a big flour tortilla, gets some cheese and some meat and some sauce, folds it together. It took him a few years, he said, before they could get something that wasn't going to ruin someone's fryer oil. And he gets something that these hot dog stands can make in their own fryer oil that can compete with pizzerias. So now the number one seller of the Il Taco company is the pizza puff.
Hmm.
Chicago made right there.
Voila. Yeah.
And that's why they're in hot dog stands. You're like, why are pizza puffs in hot dog stands? This is why.
That's crazy. I was trying to remember who said that pizza puffs will be the next Chicago food trend. Was it? Might have been Kindlesberger or Nagrant.
Like and fancy ones?
Yeah. Do you have a favorite deep dish pizza? I do.
Not
that's why
Pequod's.
I ask.
Not Pequod's. No? Everyone loves Pequod's. I think it's okay. I grew up going to Lou Malnati's birthday parties, and so I think I like Lou Malnati's.
That's your nostalgic favorite.
Yes.
That's closest to my
house. Burt's is
yeah.
pretty good, too, but yeah.
We're redesigning Lou Malnati's uniforms right now. It's kind of a dream project.
Nice.
That's very cool.
How about you?
That is a good one. I really like Uncle Jerry's in Cary, Illinois. That's Kindlesberger's top one.
Okay.
And my dad lives out there, so we make a point of going there. They have it frozen to take, but it's much better when you eat it there.
Oh, really?
It's outstanding.
Okay.
It's worth a trip to Cary.
Caramelized crust or more of a butter crust?
It's interesting because when it's frozen, it's wrapped in foil, and they tell you to tear the foil from the inside and cover the crust to protect it during reheating.
Oh, so it doesn't burn, yeah.
But it's softer and crunchier at the restaurant.
Okay. Well, next time I'm in Cary, or maybe I'll make a special
trip. No, it's worth a trip.
Okay.
Have you been to Giorgio's in Crystal Lake?
I haven't. Someone else just asked me that. Maybe you asked me that recently.
Yeah. Giorgio's is great.
Oh, man. I got to go to both
of
those.
But I like Pequod's a lot. So
yeah,
you know.
I'm just like going against the grain the whole
yeah. You're a contrarian.
But you've never been to the original, right?
I haven't, no. In That's, Morton Grove?
Yeah, Morton no. Grove.
But I'd like to go.
I'm interested in the gym shoe as well. Yeah, I've only had one, but what is the original? What's the source of it? The original location?
Well, I and others
just
have...
Just buy the book, Tim.
Yeah,
well, I'm going to.
I and others have searched and searched for the original gym in the gym shoe, unless you spell it G-Y-M, and some people do.
Do you think it was Angler that brought this kind of onto the scene?
Oh, yes. So a geneticist from the University of Chicago, Peter Angler, he was my main source on this. He brought
Angler's
me to my
great.
First. Did he tell you his great anecdote?
No, I mean, he's like the reason, though, that I went and got it.
So he's searching. He's going to every place on the south side and on the west side with the bulletproof glass. And he's saying, please tell me, owner, can you tell me the source of the gym shoe? And he's about to give up, and this guy behind the glass is like, I don't know, but one of his cooks comes over and pokes him on the shoulder and said, I can tell him. And Peter's like, oh my gosh, at last I found someone who knows the source of the gym shoe. And he's like, all right, man, tell me, what's the source of the gym shoe? Where did the gym shoe come from? And the guy said, it comes from the mind.
Like, it comes from heaven.
Well, and then I have this guy who came up with the steak and lemonade. His name is Haitham Al-Arbadi. He's from Jordan. And I said, you know, I'm so glad I finally found out where steak and lemonade comes from. Thank you so much for Haitham. I said, next, I'm really searching for the origin of the gym shoe. He said, Monica, I invented the gym shoe. I'm like, what? And I said, Haitham, how did you invent the gym shoe? He's like, one night a guy high on weed comes through my drive-thru, 3 o'clock in the morning. I'm like, okay. And he says, man, give me three meats. I don't care how you serve it, three meats. And he said, okay, what if I gave it to you on a gym shoe? And he said, how about I serve it to you on a gym shoe? And the guy's like, sure, man. And I'm like, that's so great. Thank you for telling me where the gym shoe came from. Like, what year did you do this? He's like, 2003. Like, dude, it's been on menu since 1980. I would have loved that story, but I cannot corroborate this.
Oh, I've only ever had one, and it was the place way out west on North Avenue.
I don't know the name of it, for sure.
But definitely like bulletproof glass. I think that's like
a prerequisite. Have you ever had the super crispy gym shoe?
No.
Is it a deep fried one?
Yeah, you take all the gym shoe ingredients and griddle them till they're crispy on the edges. You pile them into the middle of a giant flour tortilla, gingerly roll it up, slowly lower it into your deep fryer, hope it does not explode. It comes out crispy like the biggest egg roll you've ever seen.
Feeds a family of 10.
Yeah. All right. It's great.
Gross. This episode of Joiners is brought to you by Stock Manufacturing, makers of fine hospitality workwear. You obsess over the details in your space, so why stop at your staff's uniforms? Stock has something for every aesthetic. From fine dining to a corner cafe, they've got you covered. Choose from in-stock ready-to-wear options or design the perfect custom uniform for your team. For more information, visit stockmfgco.com.
All right, should we transition to the gratuity round?
Let's hit her with the gratuity round.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Here we go. All right,
Monica, what's your death row meal?
Oh, boy. Okay, well, I'm a Puerto Rican, so I really love, when I was a kid, my grandmother would get green plantains, and there are four kids in our family, in the first batch of our family, and she's like, oh, you guys are going only two tostones each. So tostones are a green plantain. Slice it into a disc, fry it, smash it, fry it again. And then my grandma would put garlic and salt on it. So what is a jibarito sandwich?
Yeah, exactly.
Except that tostones bread, yeah. as the bread.
Yep.
So I would eat a freshly made jibarito with...
Are you doing garlic. Lechon?
I think I'm going lechon.
Okay.
Very good question. And then some kombucha that I make at home mixed with some seltzer water. That's all I need. It's like a Puerto Rican meal on a plate.
Jibaritos are so good.
What's your favorite jibarito?
I mean, it used to be Boring Ken on California, but it's no longer
there. So jibaritos y mas is pretty good.
Okay.
There's a decent one on Western just north of Grace. Next to our apron factory.
Oh, right by Lane Tech. Yeah, that's Borinquen Bar. His brother, Angel, opened that one.
Yeah, I knew that. I think it's like the origin. He says his brother originated it.
Yeah, so Juan C. Figueroa opened the first one. His brother, Angel, who always told him to patent it, but you can't patent a sandwich, opened that one. And Juan is out of the business. I interviewed him a few years ago, and after opening three, he fell upon hard times.
Mm.
But he started the craze.
Yeah.
All right. What's your favorite hidden gem restaurant?
Favorite hidden gem?
I guess at the moment.
I guess Manta Manteles, because it's never full when I go there. And that's at Gino Bajena's place in the old Lazos.
Okay.
But like...
Right on Western and Armitage?
Yeah. Remember Lazos and Arturo's? Right, they're always next to each other.
Yeah. And then they have Little Lazos across the street now, right?
Right, which is more like Caribbean foods. Like
Cuban. Yeah, you get a Cubano.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow, I've never been to that one.
Well, it's like he's taken over this huge place that was Las Fuentes during
the signage is amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, try their Manta Mantel mole and their red mole are just mind-blowingly delicious.
Mm. That's a meal we could easily.
Yeah, you could put that on a shoe, and it's delicious. But it is kind of big to be a sort of a hidden gem. One thing that I always tell people, I do tours of Chinatown, and I start at like, let's go, well, we'll go get barbecue at King Hua or whatever. And they're like, okay, that's okay. And then I take them to this filthy little grocery store at like 24th and Wentworth. And they're like, whoa, do we really want to go in there? And then they've got ducks hanging in the window and cha siu and siu yuk. So cha siu is a barbecued pork. Siu yuk is roast pork with the crispy skin. And I get a pound of each. And I the people are mean as snakes. They're like, what do you want? And I'm like, oh, I just want some cha siu. How much? A pound? And I'm like, and bun fei, half fat. You want fatty? I'm like, yes, I do, please. And I get it, and it's warm, and it's caramely, and it's fatty. And these tourists who I'm taking around, they put it in their mouth. They're like, how is this even the same thing as the chashu we ate over there? It is unbelievable.
Wow.
But people are, you know, turned off by what doesn't look like the most appetizing little shop. It's called Tai Wa. And believe me, if you go there early on a Saturday or Sunday morning and the meat is still warm, you will be like, you'll faint. Like, it will not make it home. You will eat all of it in your hand right at that moment.
Maybe the best answer to that question we've gotten. All right. Now, I almost hate to ask this one. What's your favorite fast food?
Favorite fast food? Okay. Yeah, this is easy, cheesy. Jim's original Polish sausage, man.
How are you getting it?
With everything. So they're, you know, they're sport pepper, which is really a Serrano, and the mustard and the caramelized onions. I've timed it many times. The average from, hi, I'd like a Polish with everything, to it is in your hand, well, really in your mouth, is about 75 seconds. Like, how do they do it? How do they? Fast, delicious, inexpensive, and incredible fries. You know, it's like, how is anybody not delivering that?
Yeah.
This is the Pulaski and Grand?
No, this is the one at Union and Roosevelt.
Okay. I've not been to it.
Oh, my gosh. 24 hours a day? Or did they stop being
24 hours?
So that's
like at the highway.
Yeah. And then there's Express right next door, a cousin that they're in a feud with. So they serve the exact same thing. It's like Arturo's and Lazo's.
Wow.
Exact same thing right next to each other. And you can go anytime during day and night, unless the COVID rules are still on, which stop them from being 24 hours. Mm. And it's just breathtakingly delicious food for under like $8 in your hand in 75 seconds.
Perfect.
That would be an interesting topic for an article, like disgruntled family members who open up next to the original.
Like Geno's and Pat's in Philly and all that stuff.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Coney Dogs in Detroit.
Yeah.
Lafayette.
Yeah. There you go. Yeah, right next to each other. Yeah.
All right. What is your least favorite food?
I love all food. What I don't like are when people take shortcuts to make crappy food, or this is the least favorite thing. I hate how everything has become sweet. When I was a kid and I would go to Lou Malnati's, I loved those super red vinegary, like red wine vinegary salads. And now, like everything, there's sugar in that dressing.
Yeah.
There's sugar in all dressing, all commercial dressings.
Right.
Why? Why? I make a vinaigrette at home. It's Dijon mustard. It's red wine vinegar.
Oil.
It's olive oil. Where does sugar have to come
in?
Yeah,
no sugar.
Yeah.
But Americans have just been trained on the sugar thing, which is why we're seeing, you know, hypertension, diabetes, all sorts of metabolic disease. I cover health as well. So.
We are an unhealthy nation.
Yeah, we
should have gotten into the health. Maybe we'll have you back just to talk about that, because that is an interesting one. All right, favorite cocktail?
I have maybe had about 3 cocktails in my entire life.
Which one did you like the best?
Louisa always makes fun. Like margarita present. Oh, I know. I'm part Peruvian, a pisco sour.
Okay,
when my
okay.
Peruvian family gets together, we make pisco sours.
That's a good one.
And so there you go.
So they've only gotten together 3 times in your life.
Right, right. Well, the last time we were together, like I had a sip of those. I remember one of the things that my family did was at our restaurants, because there was that whole tiki phase, like Chinese restaurants, like you had to have all sorts of crazy cocktails. And it's terrible. One of the House of Vang menus had something called She Won't Say No. What? Like, it's like a roofie cocktail or something? Like a Cosby cocktail? Yeah, like I grew up seeing those cocktail menus. It always just seemed like grown up drank those. And
Yeah.
All right.
Fair enough.
Here's our cameo question from Sean M. Pierce on Instagram. What's the best meal you've ever had?
Oh, boy. You know, again, because I'm Puerto Rican, I remember going to Borinquen in those early days. My mom would be saying, oh, hey, let's go to Borinquen for dinner. And I would sit down and I would start with the garlicky tostones and then have arroz con gandules, which is rice and pigeon peas. and the jibarito sandwich and like really juicy lechon. And I would start humming, like, does everyone start humming? And I would feel like a buzz through my body. And maybe it was because this was the food my grandmother had always made for us as kids. Maybe it was the garlic. Maybe it was just the aroma.
It's so good.
But everything just felt so perfect. And I've also had that with Cantonese. So I'm half Chinese. Cantonese food, when I'm sitting down and eating bitter melon, which is my favorite thing in the world. Not when I was a kid and they would force us to eat it. Bitter melon and beef or bitter melon and chicken. And it just releases some sort of endorphins, some sort of happiness endorphins. So it's got to either be like a home-style Cantonese meal or Puerto Rican lechon, arroz con gandules, and tostones.
That's interesting, like a transcendent dining experience.
Yeah, it's just like, you know, I've been to like the fancy places where you got to wear a girdle and pantyhose, and I just never really, like, I'm sure you guys wear girls and pantyhose.
Yeah, all the time.
And not outside the house.
Just not, and I know the food is incredible, but I'm just not enjoying it as much.
Yeah, I hear you.
Yeah. All right, outside of food, what's your favorite band or musician?
Oh, boy. I used to cover music for a long time. And Jonathan Richman was in town at Tully Hall over the weekend, even though there was no parking at all. I should have taken a
It's impossible to park
it's
in Pilsen
so
now.
It's so frustrating to park there.
Yeah, I'm better off walking from the West Loop.
Same.
I totally should have taken an Uber or something. But I found like a 30-minute parking, and I ran in. And he's just, at 72, he's just as magical as ever with his just wide-eyed songs of the beauty of the world and heartache. Yeah. Just had a drummer and him.
So
and it was
good.
Wonderful.
My dad always plays him.
Oh, so I'm like dad music material.
All right. Favorite movie?
Favorite movie. It sounds so immature, but I think the first half of Step Brothers is really one of the best movies.
When they still hate each other?
Yeah.
Before they become friends.
I mean, just the repartee between them. And the fact that I really believe it was a commentary on the arrested development of the Bush era United States, which I thought was the worst thing that could have ever happened until the Trump era United States came. And, you know, and John C. Reilly and Will Ferrell are just so funny. But that interaction between them, and you know, and really it is sort of the petty jealousies of two blended families. I have a blended family. My partner and I, we brought our kids together, and there's a lot of joking about, you know, it's 150% your fault. We have a lot of stepbrothers isms in our family.
I know you touched my drum set.
I know you touched, yeah. Exactly. It's Shark Week.
All right, and then our last question. If you weren't doing this, all of the things that you're doing, what would you be doing?
Probably public health in the developing world. When I got out of college, the break I took was, well, so I lived in Uzbekistan doing my ex-husband's field work with him for a year and a half. I lived in England for my junior year, but in between, I went to Nicaragua to build a childcare center. And so we were there for 6 months building, and I met a lot of public health workers who were just bringing in clean water systems or helping with infant mortality. And I thought, I'm going back to the United States, screw journalism, I'm gonna get a public health degree. I want to be able to do this work. And I never did, because I'm a bad person. I went into journalism instead of helping people in the developing world. But when I retire, I said to my partner, we're going and we're digging ditches and bringing clean water systems to part of the world that needs them.
That's a good answer.
Great answer.
I have an emergent question from that. If you could change one thing about public health policy in America, what would it be?
That's a great question.
And your wish will be granted.
Yes.
Yeah. I'll see to it personally.
Yeah. Tim has the power.
I really believe we have to make healthy food both affordable, attractive, and super accessible. But that is not in the best interest of those who profit from poor health in this country. And there are a lot of people who do very well creating drugs and other things for an unhealthy public. And I think people believe that healthy food has to taste like crap, and it doesn't. But we could make it. We can make sure that the farmer and the cook and the server and everyone along the chain is paid properly if we subsidize it the way we subsidize all sorts of things like oil.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not an education thing. It's an accessibility thing.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
All right. Well, that's a wrap on Monica Ang. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. This was great.
We'll be right back. And that concludes our conversation with Monica Eng. Thanks for listening. And remember, check us out on social media. Drop us a review. Check out our video with Mindy Siegel on YouTube. I want to give a shout out to our subscribers on YouTube, all 26 of them.
Oh, wow. We have 26?
Yeah.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, I think I have 26 family members I must.
We each have 13.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm on the hook for 13. Remember, this episode was produced by Matt Haddock. Music by Captain Cuts, and of course our real work is done by the one and only Joe Guzzo III. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.